Coming up next is the show you've been waiting for, Black Op Radio.
Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream, 21 at 20K.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2,
1. Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanek.
Control room, you're on here.
Yes, we are on the air. This is Leno Sanek for show Black Op Radio, show number 305. And tonight we're going to be joined by author Lauren Singer. And I believe we have him on the line.
Good.
Well, for anyone who doesn't know, Lauren Singer wrote the book The Parallax View, which became a motion picture starring Warren Beatty. Really, it was ahead of its time in many ways, but it's a very, very interesting story. And I guess many people may have already seen it. So my questions are going to be, what got you interested in writing on the topic and... you know, what inspired you, and we'll take it from there.
Right. Well, I was assigned to the Office of Strategic Services during the war. And one of the things that we had to do before we joined the outfit was to pass a series of psychological tests. And that stayed with me for a long time because it was designed, really, to see what kind of aberrant personalities would be attracted to the whole business of espionage. And having passed and made my way through it, it stayed with me. And years later, I began to do some research about the subject generally of intelligence gathering and operatives and how they how various outfits and totalitarian governments staffed their intelligence agencies. And some of them were pretty awful, as you I'm sure are aware. And some of the material I turned up was kind of astounding. At the Nuremberg trials, a couple of American psychiatrists managed to get themselves the right to analyze as best they could the people on trial there. And they gave things like Rorschach tests to the major war criminals. Some of those appeared in a book, and I read that. Couldn't find anything really horrendous about the way they came through the Rorschachs, but some did have quite a barrett of personalities. And then it occurred to me over time that this was the sort of weapon that governments might want to adapt to control their own societies. And that's how the book came about, generally.
Right. Now, when you say government,
yeah.
In this film, it seems like it's a corporation who's a middleman working maybe not for any one government, but for a corporate interest.
Right. That's the business of outsourcing, so it's not done directly by the government, but under contract to an outside agency.
Right, and I recall a quote from Fletcher Prouty, who said, assassination is a business. Assassination is the business of big business.
I'm sure it is. I mean, I have no first-hand knowledge of it at all, but...
no, but even from reading...
you can find people who will do...
if you read the
murder, if you give them enough.
I'm thinking of newspaper articles, though, that would talk about Shell Oil and other offshore drilling rigs, how it's known they have security forces for that. So there is a corporate interest who's hired armed guards, a mercenary army, to protect its base wherever. And these guys are working for a corporate interest, not any nation.
Well, I know nothing about that, and certainly couldn't give any testimony about it.
Oh, but, yeah, no problem. I'm just saying that's just news
if
you do a search.
Well, I'm sure it exists.
Yeah.
Quite possible. But my own thing was, my own point was really pretty much reviewed better by a French magazine. And the idea, they said, after the book came out, will the enormous machine finally destroy us all under the pretext of preserving the common good? You know, the general area of eliminating a threat is as it's perceived. Here we are in the middle of the Middle East, in Iraq, containing a threat, but it isn't easily contained, and it may spread. So this is the major part of my book.
Right. Now, was this your first book?
It was yes, I wrote for television and radio before that. And I've since done four more books. Parallax this is about the 35th edition of it, I believe. And it's been published in translation all over the world.
Right, so it came out around the 1970 era?
1970 is when it did come out, yes.
Yeah, the
And book. It immediately took off, and mainly in Europe. That's where it was most admired, really.
Yeah, I'm in Canada. My printing, it says 1974, but by Dell, copyright 1970.
Right.
So you're saying it took off in Europe, so it was well received then. And, well, 35 printings.
Very. It was translated into French, Spanish, Portuguese.
So
Japanese.
You're just saying that this is something that stuck in the back of your mind since your days in the military, World War II.
Right.
So it wasn't something you just sat down in 6 months and wrote. You'd just been
at all. Yeah. It was, there was a long period of thinking about the subject generally. It one of the things that a lot of us, immediately after World War II, were struck by was the amount of influence totalitarian governments had on us, the winners of the struggle, but still supposedly able to learn something from the Germans and the French, whoever, the British. The British were the main instructors for the U.S., you know. But we still struck up a relationship with one of the most important intelligence officers in Germany, a man named Reinhard Gehlen. And the CIA worked very closely with him after World War II.
Yeah, and most people are familiar with him. He's the most famous. Because
right.
He was a German officer one day, the next day he's an American general. So,
right.
And when people think of in other areas like Wernher von Braun and Dornberger, things
that,
people that were assimilated, and they said, you're either going to jail or you're working for us.
If you wanted to design missiles and jets, that's where you went. Certainly saved a lot of research time. And everyone was happy to see the results here.
Now, before I get too in-depth into the book with questions that I do have, tell me about the movie. How happy or unhappy were you with that?
I didn't like it at all. I didn't like it because the screenwriters did not read the book closely or could not really find the thread that they needed to make a good movie out of it. If they had, you know, the movie should have had more of a, what I'm saying is the movie should have had more of a head on it. And this one didn't. It was just a lot of running around to no purpose. The novel has a very definite simple structure goes from one chapter to another and one happening to another, and they're all carefully linked. And that's what the movie failed at. It had a lot of lively gimmicks in it, like shooting somebody on the Space Needle, but really that wasn't the story at all, so I didn't like it much.
I'm sorry about that, because I thought that the movie served a purpose in really making you think on the topic. And where I had missed your book, I've seen the movie. And I found it, the whole idea disturbing. It really made me think about looking into it more. I thought the editing was, it's a shame I've only read the book lately.
Yep.
But I've seen the movie and you know, a few times I've seen it. So as I'm reading the book, it is a little different, and it goes off in different directions with more character and depth, you know, things like that.
Well, I will say that my sons all like the movie very much.
Well, I think that the sequence during the testing is almost classic. You can watch that on YouTube, but for anyone who can't find the movie,
yeah.
Last week I urged people to go out and dig the DVD up. It was re-released, I think, in 1996.
Yeah.
And a DVD, so that was one, you know, interesting thing, that the movie didn't just die out. But
well, I haven't seen it in a while. Maybe I'll take another look.
It may grow
on me.
Well, I found the book a little, you know, knowing the story from the movie, I found the book a little hard to read, because I kept thinking, well, this isn't how it goes. They're doing it different, you know. But I don't want to give anything away if somebody reads the book or the movie. And, of course, that's why I'm asking you what you liked or you didn't like.
I've seen it maybe two or three times, and it just didn't stay with me. And movies that I have really very much admired do stay with me forever, to the point where I can repeat some of the dialogue, you know?
Yeah.
Like, John Huston stuff.
Well, I don't want to go overboard with the praise now, because it did seem like the movie somehow ended up being in the B grade, but still, you know, a B grade movie, just not a top notch. There was something a little missing from it. It could have had something, and I don't know what that is.
I agree. I think it ought to be done again by somebody who understands the point of the book better.
Yeah. But I think even the topic is really where you'd have to come into agreement with the filmmaker and the author, because
no, you can really apply the book very much, very closely, to what's going on with us now in the business of defending the country against terrorism. Nobody can really identify the threat, where it is, how it's coming. It's a threat, but it's sort of a gauzy one. You never can tell where, how. And the book said that this is going to happen, and you're going to have something, some mechanism in place that will unite the country, whether it's against terrorism or whatever the hell they may call it, in order to survive.
Right.
And at least that's what people will be told.
Right, and people made reference to something having to be like a new Pearl Harbor. And, of course, 9/11 comes along.
Right.
I want to get a little bit more into the ideas that you talk about in the book. And the one thing is this testing for government or for corporate interest. You make reference to the Macbeth Society. Is that what these guys call themselves?
That was supposed to be some sort of a nasty comment by the guy. I don't remember it, actually. I remember writing it, but
the main character is asking, who do you work for?
Call it, right.
And he said, well, we call ourselves the Macbeth Society. I just wondered if you had anything more to that, right? You also make reference then to, on various intros to the chapters, quoting from the handbook.
Right.
Can you give us any insight to what that was going to represent?
As a matter of fact, there is no handbook. There are just quotes from it, and I wrote them very carefully to indicate that this was, you know, the bright side of the operation that was being conducted. And interestingly, I got a letter from the head of a huge tobacco company who wanted to buy a copy of the handbook and give it to each of his employees. And I wrote back and told him that it just didn't exist. And he didn't believe me. He kept pushed the publisher, everybody, complaining that I refused to sell him the material that appeared at the head of all these chapters. It was, I just couldn't discourage him. I don't know whether he's still at it or not.
I would have made one up for him.
I don't think there was enough money in it.
No, it would have been smoking is bad, from the handbook writers.
It was, as a matter of fact, he found it. He found the book in England, and he thought that that's where Parallax was based or something. But, the idea of an outfit getting ready to do this sort of job is not exactly new. It really, you can find parts of it somewhere or other in the U.S., in the history of the U.S.
Right, but it's the idea that it's new to those who have no idea it exists. And what you're talking about here is not exactly mind control, but a screening for people that will be used in these kind of operations, which may, like, the movie has a certain parallel to the Robert Kennedy assassination. It doesn't really say that. In the book, you don't really mention what they saw. I think you only hint at it, and it kind of bothered me that it wasn't more descriptive to me.
That was absolutely deliberate. I thought that would, to offer this as a, some sort of a solution for both Kennedy assassinations was absolutely the wrong way to go. And I deliberately did not mention either.
Well, what do you mean by solution?
To how the Kennedy assassinations came about, who was involved, who could possibly have been involved. I didn't want to have any part of that because I didn't know anything.
But when you're writing this, you make it sound like it's a famous event, like the death of a president or some assassination that these people have witnessed, and
right.
Someone is going out to remove the witnesses. Now, it seems that Parallax is a corporation, but yet the only... it's only a government would have the inclination to go and remove witnesses. So they're hiring this.
Or your sense that a corporation could do it too. If they paid enough money to Parallax, they'd find them any sort of medium they could.
That's definitely what you get out of the book because it goes into more detail.
Right, I didn't.
But like I'm saying in the film, although the Space Needle in Seattle and... I think it's just the way that they had the staff there looking like they were service staff, like in the Ambassador Hotel, in the pantry area, and these guys all were holding the maitre d' towels and things like that. There was just that kind of era, and I think it had that that sense. In the book, it seems to be further back in time, maybe around the early 60s or something like that, that I got the idea. That's where, if you read the book, you may be thinking about it was the John F. Kennedy assassination. It could be anything, right? But like I say, not that you didn't give that away, but you definitely steered away from letting anyone know what they saw. They all were a witness to something,
right?
And from then on, people were being removed.
I'd like to add one more thing. There was a story in the Time, I think it was an AP story, that linked the deaths of a number of journalists to the assassination. I think there was something like 10 of them. And some of them were really hardly to be associated. But the story ran, and I saw it, and I remember it having an effect on me, because I thought it was preposterous. I couldn't imagine what use there would be for it, except finally it came to me, something like this. Why would it be done? What is the point in the conspiracy? What was it supposedly to do? Who was it meant to bring about? What was it meant to bring about?
Was this before you wrote the book?
Pardon?
Was this before you wrote the book?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So you're saying that that idea came to you where you had seen a list of people that died in unlikely circumstances,
right.
And was there a connection? And
right,
at first you scoffed at it, and then after you were thinking about it, you thought that there might be more to the story.
Right, so I put it together with what I had known about psychological testing and recruitment of people who would do anything.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
And this is what came out. There's nothing original ever.
No, I think what's surprising, though, is that when I was thinking of the story that the recruitment would come from inside the military, and here they were recruiting from anywhere.
Mm. No, it never occurred to me to bring the military in at all. I didn't, in the first place, I didn't think it was anything that they would possibly have anything to do with. In the OSS, we had a number of military, not the military men, but none of them ever became assassins or were assigned to that sort of operation that I knew of. They could very well have been, but I didn't see it.
And what era was that?
That was in World War II. And you're aware, I'm sure, that the man who put the OSS together was Major General Donovan, William Donovan. He was one of the Brits' favorite Americans. He was committed to the survival of Britain, and he went over and surveyed the whole of Europe on behalf of President Roosevelt. He came back and filed a report and said, this is what we ought to be doing. We need an intelligence gathering outfit. So they put the OSS together. He did. And he recruited numerous specialists, psychologists, psychiatrists, geographers, foreign language experts, everything that he needed, plus engineers and peculiar weapons instructors. So it was an interlocking scene, the whole area for me. And it fascinated me forever.
Right, and I think I've got a quote written down here. I'm not sure it's from the handbook or not, but it says, does the government have the right and or the duty to eliminate numbers of its citizens to ensure its survival? And that's kind of what you were talking about earlier. This is the question, who's going to stop or who has the right to decide if this is acceptable?
Right. I remember that. It's not my quote, it's somebody else's. But that's pretty much what the book was all about, and that's what we're skating. I think we're skating around the edge of this sort of thing right now, with Guantanamo, putting people in there and not letting them out, and preventing any sort of trial or judgment. And who knows how many didn't make it to Guantanamo. Nobody knows, and nobody will probably ever find out. If they were caught in flagrante delicto, I'm sure they're gone now.
Yeah, but in that case, it's more cut and dry that America has declared a war. They have sent troops over there, and there's a battle going on.
Sure.
So this is more covert. I don't know if sinister is the right word, but it's your idea in the book, The Parallax View, and in the film, that there are whole networks and teams ready to do the bidding of a corporate interest or a government interest, and it's much more sophisticated than anyone would ever know. And the recruitment and the screening procedures are very intricate. And in the film, the one staggering, really monumental part is that the six-minute segment where he sits down in front of, it's kind of a projector in a screening room, and they want his reaction to this view of what America's all about and where does he see himself.
Mm.
And it's quite powerful, that six-minute clip. Now, you kind of describe it differently in your book, in the series of tests. You recall the segment I'm talking about.
I really don't, as a matter of fact.
Oh, okay. I found it powerful because it was always
pictures. But I would like to add one thing.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be a government operation that brings this about. You can find the same sort of elimination organization in Mafioso. The family that puts together a small army of its own to eliminate all its enemies. It's possible.
Right. But in that case, I never imagined any kind of organized, coordinated screening effort, as is hinted at in your novel and the film. That's the thing I think that most people found eye-opening and disturbing, that kind of after you see it, you grow up a little bit, you say, of course there must be that in place, right?
Mm.
And like you mentioned, for governments, even at war in World War II, and intelligence organizations, well, I never thought of it before, but they must have these screening procedures. And if they need people for assassinations and removal of governments, who are they going to call? I guess they're going to have some kind of organized screening. And in the book, I think one of the psychiatrists is more interested that one of these guys was able to trick his way in.
Right.
Where in the movie, it's kind of glossed over a little bit, but that's why they even spoke to him, I guess. And I'm thinking with the scene in the restaurant where he gets to finally meet one of the hires up in Parallax.
Right, there was a truly murderous creature, the one who was about to do away with the director, and he knew it. It takes one to know one, I guess.
And the final two applicants kind of are pitted against each other. That's
sure.
Kind of another ironic area there too.
As a matter of fact, that's what there was a competition. When you went into the OSS, everybody dressed in fatigues without any ID and with a fake name. And we went to a farm in Virginia for 3 days of psychological testing. And they were given all sorts of problems, mostly fakes. But they were supervised by psychologists, and nobody ever passed the final exam, which was you were caught in a secure office with your hands in a file cabinet, and you had to explain what you were doing there and why, and you couldn't make a very good case for yourself. But if you wanted to stay in the course, you had to ask for something called X conditions, in which case they ran you up three floors at the top speed and sat you down in front of a very fatherly-looking, gray-haired psychiatrist who would say, "Tell me what your explanation is." And everybody, without any doubt, would never remember to ask for X conditions. They started to blurt out why they wanted to join the OSS, or the OSS, and stay there, and how good they'd be at it, and so on and so on. So they all failed, one after the other. But they were accepted anyhow, since there wasn't any standard for success. At any rate, it was one that had its standards set too high. But it was really a key to the whole situation. You know, there's never any finite answer to what people will do or why. And some of them get there all by themselves.
Right, but in the book,
committing murder or rape or anything else.
You made it quite clear, though, in the book that these guys in the Parallax Corporation of Screening were very interested in where a culture was going and changing, so that applicants that they may have thought failed 5 years later, they would be passing, that they were really, they didn't want to exclude any of the, anyway, Graham's results, the main character there. They thought they would just gloss it over, and then there's comments made, no, we've got to keep all results in here because it may be showing a new trend, that he's the first of a new trend of applicant, if I'm getting that correct.
I think you're right.
Yeah, and so that's what, you know, struck me just how structured something like this would be. That, you know, you've got your kind of corporate world, the facade of it, of, you know,
right,
people applying for jobs, but this is a
whole... It's become more and more complex, the business of bringing people into to a high-level job, for example. There's nothing simple about it anymore. It's not just a matter of somebody patting them on the back and saying, take this one. So things have changed and are continuing to change. And I'm sure that the people in my own little area, the ones who are running Parallax, were certain to have backups all over the place for whenever and wherever they would need them. It was that sort of they were that sort of far-seeing group. Or they seemed to be to me.
Well, as you say that, what I'm thinking about was at the end of your book, and it's quite an interesting topic, so I don't think by giving away near the end we're going to give away anything. I think people are going to watch the movie or get the book regardless.
Mm.
But I was curious that it did not appear to me that it was when there was a car chase at the end and one car is dumped up upside down, that was his other friend. It seemed to me this was a new person, a new assassin.
Oh, you mean the college professor? Where he left the kid?
No. Just, you know, in the epilogue, Graham's driving away, and there's this old Chrysler chasing him.
Right.
Until finally they're driving down this long ramp out to a ferry or a boat dock
right.
or something like that, right? I'm talking about when the police that come to the scene, who do they pick up there? That's somebody new? That's somebody new that they think that has done away with?
I meant him to be just another one of the recruits from Parallax.
Right, that's what I meant. So I meant, I get the impression then that even though he was, Graham was afraid of his rival there.
Right.
The last guy in the group, it was a witness. He didn't have to be afraid of him. There was somebody new to take over.
Sure.
The whole thing has got this kind of theme
running
through it.
Took me forever to figure out that epilogue. I wanted there to be some hope, you know? So that I gave the police the sense that this was not a simple act of bad driving. And that's what I hope I did.
Yeah, I did get that from it, except for the fact that I was just thinking to myself, what an uphill battle for... I thought, well, this is a policeman that should be a detective then, because he's pretty quick to be examining, reflecting on the guy's story and what he sees in a roll bar in the car, and I think you say some reinforcing
right.
on the... And so things like that. So here he goes, okay, we're already on the track. This isn't just any little accident, right? And the guy's story doesn't wash. So the way you're saying it, I want there to be a little hope, but I'm thinking of what he's up against, and it's like, oh my God. So I kind of got the opposite. I thought, even though there's hope, there's no hope. Because these guys...
We could have been helpful.
Well,
two of us.
Yeah, there was eight of them, though, in the beginning, right, that had witnessed it. It was a team group of people, and they were reporters, photographers, that had witnessed something they weren't... Or something happened in front of them that, like in the movie, when they start thinking about what they had seen, there was somebody there that was out of place, and somehow a photograph emerges of... They recognize that this wasn't an accident.
Well, the French put a whole group of photographers and reporters on the jacket.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Yeah, the jacket I have as looks like a roll of film, and it has each person across it, and there's one lone guy.
What do you have, a Doubleday edition?
Dell.
Dell?
Dell.
Well, there's a new one out that's terrific. Big trade paperback from an outfit called Ex Libris. Very good.
Well, that's good. I was able to find
36.
This, so people can find it on Amazon.com.
Yeah, you can.
And even if it had to be a used book, which mine was, it was in perfect condition, though. And I mean, just
well, this is a new one.
Yeah.
The Ex Libris edition was for sale at Amazon and Borders, I believe. I haven't spoken to them in a while, so I don't know.
You weren't exactly happy with the film. But is there anything good about it that you, like, for instance, when you, how did they approach you? Did you meet the director, and did they run by with their ideas for the movie? And
no,
they just.
I didn't want to do the screenplay at all. And
so they just optioned your book, saying we're interested in making a film, and we'll take care of everything.
Right. They paid a good price for it, and it was up to them. But the I will say the head of Doubleday didn't like what they did with it at all. And one of the screenwriters was, I think he did Downhill Racer. That was his major credit before this. I don't think he was supposed to, I don't think he was capable of doing a book like this.
Well, in defense of any film or book, they always say you should have read the book. The book is better than the movie. So,
very true.
Yeah. I mean, even I was a fan of, you know, kind of a similar film that was The Manchurian Candidate.
Of course.
And I love the Frank Sinatra version. The new one that came out, I didn't like at all, really.
The Manchurian Candidate was much better written than Parallax. I mean, Frank Sinatra was a little much, but the script itself was excellent, I thought.
Yeah.
I never read the book.
No, and I hadn't read the book either. In fact, I hadn't seen the movie because the movie was kind of locked up for a while. They released it in 63, and then for some reason they thought it would be in bad taste or something like that, a political assassination, and after Kennedy gone. And I think it wasn't until around 1970 or 75 or something that finally they decided to, with the advent of video and DVDs coming out, they would re-release it.
Never knew it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have all the facts straight, but that's just the rough story. I heard that movie sat around for a long time until finally they re-released it. And if you get the DVD now, you get Frank Sinatra talking, I think, with the, you know, like a 20-minute little excerpt of him discussing his recollections of the film and filming. And was it Frankenheimer?
I'd like to see that.
No, Frankenheimer, I think, was the filmmaker. Yeah.
Frankenheimer?
Yeah.
But yeah, he was a good director.
Yeah, so, you know, so many things. And, of course, people say that nobody goes out to make a bad film, so you're always interested in what you didn't like about it or in what screening areas people thought that the story was too complicated or not complicated enough.
I did make a mistake when I sold the rights to Parallax. I think I sold them too soon because a director I admired very much, Frenchman, Costa Gavras, came in with an offer for it, but it was too late. But I did work with him on another project, so it wasn't all bad.
Has there been any interest in remaking the film?
No, I think it's capable of a new shot myself.
And is that something that you have the rights to re-release?
I really haven't looked at the contract in a long time. I don't know. But it, you know, if there are ways to get around this, if somebody wants to take a property and make it again, they can manage it. It doesn't. There's no overwhelming cost to it. So I'd like to see it done sometime.
Now I have a couple other questions here, just about the book. And going through it, I don't know why this struck me as maybe odd or something of real note. In the words, in the printing of the book, the actual language here, you have the word baggage and interview capitalized several times, wherever they're talking about a baggage claim and the interview and number. Is there any significance to that?
It's meant to impress instructions on a particularly, in case somebody's low-level in intelligence, you know, in case they have to have something to fix on in the way of instructions. So the interview is supposed to be the major point in this whole exchange, and they're supposed to understand that. In other words, if they want to go further in this very promising area, they have to obey all these instructions exactly. And that's what I was trying to do with those capitalizations and the instructions. Read well also.
Okay, well, I guess I'm low level enough I just kind of fell for it, because I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, he's handing over a baggage claim to a secretary, but you're just talking about the language, so why would you capitalize it in the book? Unless it's for me reading it, and I'm supposed to think this is really important. So don't lose the baggage claim number here, and you're going for the interview, and that's what made me even think enough to bother asking. So it seemed to me, is this a code word for something later on? And I must say that I was a little disappointed near the end of the book where they two start reminiscing about just what they had witnessed. And you started talking about that, you know, what it was. And I thought, oh, good. All this time I waited. I'm wondering what the hell they saw. And you're going to talk about it now. And then it just kind of goes right by. And I thought, oh, damn it, right? You know, just say it was the John F. Kennedy assassination or something. Tell me whatever it was, right?
Sorry.
Yeah.
It was a Zapruder film in the front, so you know that. That's the way it opened.
Yeah, with the film, but it didn't say Zapruder film, did it?
No.
Right. So I
probably didn't have, at the time, I probably didn't have the right to even mention Zapruder, because Time Life was really very careful to guard every inch of its rights on the thing. They actually made it an asset of the corporation so that it couldn't be mishandled in any way. That's the way I understood it. So I stayed away from it completely. There wasn't anything to be gained by it anyhow. Everybody knew what I was talking about.
Well, I guess maybe at that time so many other things have gone by that so many other political events, and of course just those four assassinations of John...
Sure.
And Bobby and Martin Luther King and that. It really could have been anyone.
Right.
So, in fact, it's so common it would be on TV shows.
I had a good friend who wrote a philosophy professor at Haverford, who wrote a book called 6 Seconds in Dallas, in which he analyzed every inch of the route and the circumstances, everything, and published it. And... somebody sued him for...
Are you talking about Josiah Thompson?
That's the guy.
Right.
Do you know him?
No, I don't know him personally, but that's what I'm thinking about, 6 Seconds in Dallas.
Yeah, Tink Thompson.
Right, okay, yeah.
He was terrific. But somebody sued him, and I think it was Time Life. They were awarded all the royalties he earned on the book. I don't know how. I don't know the circumstances. What he had done. I read the book. It didn't seem to me that he was transgressing in any way. I just don't know.
Yeah, imagine that. At least with this day and age of the Internet, people are able to post things up.
They can lay their hands on anything.
Then the next step, is it going to be disinformation or not, right?
Listen, do you want to do this again sometime?
That's fine. I've pretty well asked most of the questions I wanted to talk about with the book. I'd be glad to talk to you again another time as well, too. Look, is there anything that I didn't get to yet that you want to bring up?
No, I think you've been very thorough. I haven't spoken this much about the book in a long time, and it was a pleasure.
Okay, then.
I've enjoyed it.
All right, well, thanks. I enjoyed the film. I enjoyed the book. You know, even further, it got me thinking further. You read the book, and you put it down, or even the film, and you walk out, and you say, now, there's a lot to that. What more should I know? That I don't know, and this is just kind of lifting the lid, I think, to letting people getting an idea of how complex and how organized something would be in that kind of business. And that it does go on, and if you don't know about it, that's, you know, up to you. But
I think we covered a lot of ground.
Okay,
at least,
well,
I hope so.
Very good, then. Well, Lauren, thanks very much for the interview.
And I'll
phone you in a while to see if I can't figure out our email problems, but hopefully one day I'll be able to get an email.
That would be great. I'll take you up on it.
Okay, then.
Thank you, Leonard.
Okay, thanks very much.
Bye.